Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. In this week's Dharma Talk by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg, we continue our series on the lives of the Karmapas, focusing on the 12th and 13th Karmapas. The 18th century in Tibet were tumultuous times. There were invasions, occupations, political upheaval, and power struggles. The 12th and 13th Karmapas were not disengaged from all the tumult, but did not allow their lives to become entangled by it. In the face of those compelling times, they knew their priorities and accomplished bodhisattva activity, deepened the teachings, and made positive contributions wherever they could, in spite of the difficult circumstances. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, thank you for coming. We're going to continue in this book, which is a pretty wonderful book, The History of the Karmapas. And the book is a series of biographies. We've been slowly working our way through it. And today we're going to do the 12th and the 13th Karmapas. As I was preparing for this, you know, it's funny, these two Karmapas, on the one hand, don't have as much biographical material as some of the other ones. There's plenty there. But I started reading between the lines a little bit, and it turns out there was a lot of political turmoil in Asia in general, and Tibet, Nepal, China in particular, in the 18th century when this all takes place. So I started to read about that because lately, I have to confess, I find our politics, the stuff we're dealing with, it kind of exhausting and somewhat frustrating and a little bit saddening and so on. And then I started to read what the Karmapas were dealing with. We're getting pelted with marshmallows compared to what they're dealing with. And so it started to be really interesting to me to see how they worked with that, how they held their own minds, and what kind of blessings they were giving, what kind of work they were doing. And I was inspired by that. So I want to share about these two Karmapas today from that point of view. And in a sense, since we're followers of the Karmakaju lineage and the Karmapas here, you use these guys as inspiration, which I think is part of their job, is to be inspiring for us. And I hope that you come away with some clear sense of vision, some refreshment, if you're like me and you get a little bit tired and exhausted by the barrage of news and politics that we have right now. Because actually, their example gives us some kind of sense of the value of being in these kind of times. I mean, suffering sucks. It really does. There's no doubt about that. At the same time, it's the door to compassion. And it's the door to developing really skillful means. In other words, ways to work with our minds that we wouldn't normally necessarily ever be inspired or insightful enough to recognize. So on the one hand, we can honor actually these times and the difficulties of them as our doorway to growth and strengthening ourselves, and also understanding that we can't hold on to them either. We have to let them go and do our thing. There's this story that I want to use as an introduction to chanting the refuge prayer together. Someone asked one of the great Indian sages of the 20th century, a guy named Nisargadatta, what ultimate realization was like. And he gave a three-part answer. When we say the refuge prayer three times, one understanding is that that's what we're doing, is we're engaging in a threefold refuge, refuge at three levels. And this is the way he described the three levels. He said the first level is, all of a sudden, you realize you're in a tiger-infested jungle, but you're in a strong steel cage. You're protected and you don't worry. Second level is, you're wandering around free in the jungle, but the tigers are in a cage, so you don't worry. Third level is, you're wandering around in the jungle, and so are the tigers, and you ride the tigers. So these tigers can be external or internal circumstances that we have. They can be our politics, they can be our daily life of relationships and work and all of that. Or they can be in our inner life, our emotions and our thoughts. As we all know, we all have afflictive emotions and difficult thoughts because, I mean, that's why we practice, right? And what practice does, what if we follow what the Karmapa taught us, it first gives us protection. It first shelters us. They say mantra, for instance, is protection for the mind. If you do mantra practice all day long, you try it sometime if you don't do it, you'll notice that it's like being protected. It's like being in a protected enclosure. It's kind of wonderful. If you do Tonglen off the cushion all day long, it's like wandering around and taking whatever it is and realizing that as things come up, once again, you can transform them in a protected space and turn them into something positive and develop compassion. If you come to the place where you can just look at your thoughts directly as they arise, and this takes a little practice, and there's a path for that, and we teach that here, you realize you can ride whatever comes, whatever tiger it is. And so this is essentially the path of the Karmapas. The reason that the home monastery is called Karma Triyana Dharma Chakra is, Triyana means the three turnings. Those are the three turnings. The turning of self-liberation, the turning of the great vehicle, which is transforming everything in the state of kindness and compassion, wisdom and skillful means, if you will. And the third turning is recognize your own Buddha nature. You can ride all the tigers. They're all yours. You indeed can tame them and use them as vehicles. Same thing here. Karma Tegsam Choling means exactly the same thing, except in Tibetan instead of Sanskrit. So we chant the refuge prayer together at the beginning of these talks three times in a way of celebrating our personal liberation, the birth of compassion in ourselves, and the birth of insight into our own true nature, which is our Buddha nature. So those are my preliminary comments. And that goes for whether or not you've got Mongols taking over the central the central country of Tibet or actors in Washington doing what they do. It's like those three turnings are still always available to you. That's why we're here, is simply to learn about that, learn to work with it, and to be reminded, oh, I know that, I can use that. Let's do that. That's better than just whatever kind of escape, you know, I might have. There's no escape. I think Pema Chodron wrote a book called The Wisdom of No Escape. It's kind of like that. Yeah, you're in the jungle, even if you think you can get away, you know. TV won't help. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll won't help. I just saw Rocket Man the other day. If you get to see it, it's a great movie, but it's a little tough, you know. Elton John thought he could escape sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It didn't work, long story short. It's true for us. So here we are. We're going to bravely face the way things are and realize that it's all workable. Trungpa Rinpoche used to say that the lion's roar, which is a famous thing that we talk about as Buddhists, the lion's roar. The lion's roar is looking at whatever situation you're in and saying, it's workable. That's it. It's fearless. It's brave. So with that in mind, and with gratitude for the Karmapas who have been fearless for 1,000 years, and led us in that path. Let's say the refuge prayer together. I'm going to chant it 3 times in Tibetan. If you know it, please join me. And if you're not familiar with it, just join in your hearts in sort of the way that I've been talking, that we have these refuges on every level, all the way along. All we have to do is recognize it. Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jinso Gipe Sunam Gi Drola Pinchir Sanjay Truparsho Sanjay Judang Soki Chognam La Changju Pardu Dakni Kyab Suchi Daki Jin So Gipe Sunam Gi Drola Pinshir Sanjay Druparsho Sanje Judang Soki Chognam La Jangshu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Yipe So Nam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanje Druparsho. Thank you. Well, so, what was going on? In the 18th century in China, the Mongols had been ruling in central China, and they were a fractious bunch, needless to say. I mean, you know, Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, they were pretty famous for being kind of marauding as it was. And they liked power. Karmapas had power. So all through the years, Karmapas always got invited to the Mongol hordes and to be teachers of the various Khans. From my reading of history, I'm not sure they were as interested in inner development as they were interested in power. And that's one of the things about a popular religion. There's a lot of people that follow. And there's this little mystical element, like something magically could happen. And so that attracts people who naturally want power, and because they want all those magical powers, right? And so they want to know the most powerful lamas, and the Karmapas were them. But I think I mentioned last time, they invaded central Tibet about 100 years earlier, and they kind of co-opted a bunch of Gelugpa monasteries, and some warlords were around back then, and there was kind of this thing where you had to choose sides, sort of, because patronage was necessary in order to support the monasteries. You know, it's just like we're trying to rebuild a Buddhist center. We need our patrons and stuff like that. And it could be, you know, if we had these kind of power-hungry people and we were powerful, which I don't suppose is in the mix right now, somebody might want to trade money for power. Okay. Well, at that time, the great fifth Dalai Lama came into power, and they decided this is the guy who's really got the juice in central Tibet. So they said goodbye to the Karmapas, who were mostly the lamas for nomadic herdsmen up in Kham. And they said hello to the Dalai Lamas. And the Dalai Lama, to his credit, didn't really want to have much to do with them. However, because of the patronage system, some of the local royalty who supported the Dalai Lamas decided they were going to cast their lots with the Mongols because they looked like that was the best game in town for power and money. And, you know, it's a human enterprise. People are people. And that happened. And as we talked about, the 10th Karmapa was, you know, it wasn't the monks, but it was the clans that followed the Dalai Lama in the central Tibet didn't listen to him really well, and they chased the 10th Karmapa all over the place. You know, he had his encampment. He basically lived in a tent city that moved from place to place because they were marauding and destroying monasteries and villages and stuff like that. Well, this all continued for a while. And meanwhile, as the Karmapas went along, they just continued to be very apolitical. That's one of the hallmarks of the Karmapas throughout all the years, is they just don't want to be involved in politics. I suppose because they understand the impermanence of that whole power thing and how fragile it is and how distracting it is. You can't really... It's a lot of work to gain power politically. It takes a lot of time. Anybody here who's worked on political campaigns knows that. Well, if you're spending all your time and your passion doing that, you're not going to be doing your nundro, man. You're going to be too busy trying to... It's just the way it is. And so the Karmapas were interested in priorities. I think it was Khandro Rinpoche who says, with a great big smile on her face that could, you know, penetrate the sun itself. Big smile, she says. Life is short. Prioritize. And that was sort of where the Karmapas were. Because of that, the people, their patrons, became the warlords in central Tibet. And of course, the warlords and the Mongols, they were doing their thing. And the Karmapa was just interested in making sure the monasteries were safe. So he had some local guys who were protectors. That's good. Well, the fifth Dalai Lama died. One of the Karmapa's attendants was also basically Secretary of State of Tibet and Central Tibet, working with the Gelugpas. And they decided they couldn't, they couldn't deal with the transfer of power properly. They didn't, things were too in too much upheaval, and they hid the fact that the fifth Dalai Lama had passed and didn't identify the sixth for a long time. And that's sort of where we start. Right at that time, the Mongols that were there actually had a war with other Mongols. And a whole new clan took over central Tibet. The old guys lost, the new guys won. And of course, a lot of the old people had to go. It's like politics in America, right? It's like the Republicans win, all the Democrats go. They're not going to be in the White House doing the administration. Same thing here. And all of that was going on, all those alliances. And meanwhile, in China, the Han Dynasty fell. And the Han were the biggest population in China. Well, this was a big deal. Who took over? The Manchus. Manchus were interesting. Manchus were the guys who were subjugated by the Han. They were made to wear the long ponytails and stuff like that. They got to cut their ponytails off because that was a symbol of being subservient. And they took over. And the Manchus invited the Karmapas to come to Beijing. And the Karmapas were interested in teaching the Dharma wherever, and particularly were interested in maybe being able to build some monasteries in China, you know, because they wanted to spread the Dharma. That's sort of what they thought their priority should be. And so they got aligned with the Manchus. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the Karmapa, see, this is great stuff. The Karmapa, as you know, has a few different what they call heart sons, right? So there is Shamar Rinpoche, there's the Taisitu Rinpoche. Taisitu is actually a name bestowed on that mind stream by a Chinese emperor a couple hundred years before. And Jaltsup Rinpoche was around at the time. He had been identified and so on. Shamar Rinpoche was actually the last couple at that time had been either connected to or actually part of the royal family of Nepal, another political entity. And the Nepalese had this long lineage that had lasted hundreds of years called the Nuars, and they were famous. They had, there's a whole style of art called Nuar, and I think these Tonkas here are in that style, for instance. Well, they got overthrown at that time. Have you heard of the Gurkhas? The Gurkhas, the Gurkha warriors, and they had those knives that were curved like this and then curved like this, the blade. And they, you know, so they could hack people up when they were fighting. They took over. So that sets the scene for what's going on. All of this, and it's gotten pretty close in the sense that Shamar Rinpoche, due to family dynamics, I think, wanted to remain connected to the power in Nepal. And that had a big impact and continues to this day to have a big impact, and we'll get into that. The emperor, there were two emperors in China during this period, just like there were two Karmapas. One was Yongchen emperor, and the other was Quanzong. Yongchen was solidifying his power, and he invited the 12th Karmapa there. And we'll get to that part of the story in a minute. 12th Karmapa never made it. Quanzong was interesting. It's one more piece of political, environmental information you need. He wanted to be known as a sage king, a Dharma king. It's a big deal to be a Dharma king. There have been Dharma kings all along. They tend to be really supportive of the Dharma, of course, but also incredibly skillful in terms of running their country. So people are happy, prosperity is good, and all that. Qianlong was half of that. He liked the idea of getting all the transmissions and becoming wise and being involved only in the arts and the spirituality, and he didn't do too good a job running his country. And so what happened was a lot of corruption began to take hold towards the end of his life, and that continued on. The Manchus ran China well into the 19th century. I think all the way through, maybe, until the rebellions in the late 19th century. So they were around, but what started out pretty good ended up to be corrupt. And, you know, you had things like the Boxer Rebellions and the Opium Wars and all that that was happening later on. And it all came from this guy who was trying to follow the Dharma only as a source of wisdom without really learning skillful means. In other words, how to mind his business and take care of his country. Okay. So that's part of the no escape part. He had responsibilities and he tried to run away and it turned out badly. So the 12th Karmapa, he got the name Jangchub Dorje, which means Vajra of enlightenment. He didn't live a long time. He was born in 1703 and he died in 1732. That happens to Karmapas a lot. They don't tend to have long lives, which I think is very interesting. He was born in the exact place that the 11th Karmapa predicted he would be reborn. And he was identified by Mingyur Dorje Rinpoche. The current Mingyur Rinpoche is, I don't know which emanation or rebirth, but we've got a Mingyur Rinpoche around right now who's pretty wonderful. This particular Mingyur Rinpoche was extraordinary in many ways. The medicine Buddha practice we practice was something that he transmitted. The Karma Pakshi practice, which is one that you do, a lot of people do after they complete Nundro, because it is a direct doorway to Ma Mudra realization. That came from him, and so on and so forth. He was an extraordinary being. Anyway, he identified the 12th Karmapa, and he let Shamar Rinpoche know that he'd found him. And Shamar Rinpoche came in and gave him all the tests and stuff like that. And they were pretty sure that they had the right guy. At the age of 7, he met Taisitu, the 8th Taisitu Rinpoche, who was extraordinary in himself. Some people say the greatest of all the Taisitus. And Taisitu was 10 and became the student of the 7-year-old Karmapa, which I think is sweet. Can you imagine this 7-year-old and 10-year-old together? It's totally great. Anyway, they had a lot of support from Mingyur Rinpoche. They had a lot of Nyingma teachers that they were very close to at the time. And not so much the Gelugpa, because there was some stress still in the air with all the politics that was going on. But they grew up in that environment together. And they ended up journeying. This guy did a lot of moving around. He wasn't too stationary too many times. And he went to see the king of Nangchen, which is in the northwest region of Kham, which is an interesting place. It was called the land of meditators. It's nice. The word for meditation in Tibetan is gom. Gom isn't really meditation. I mean, there is no word in Tibetan for meditation. Do you guys know that? The written language was created to transmit the Dharma. They didn't have a written language until the Dharma came to Tibet. Anyway, even though that's the case, there is no word for that's meditation. Meditation is kind of a conceptual word. Gom, which is used, it means getting used to. So the idea of meditation in Tibet is getting used to the nature of your own mind. That's why you do the practice. The assumption is the nature of your mind is ultimate goodness. So that's what you want to get used to. It's what you want to know. They say that the pointing out instructions, which are kind of closely guarded things now in this world, in this diaspora, was taught to everybody in Nangchen. And everybody, whether they were peasants or whether they were merchants or whether they were royalty, whether they were nomadic or stationary, everybody practiced Ma Mudra meditation. That's why it was called the land of meditation. People's houses, their family houses, became meditation centers there. And people as simple as water bearers would just sit down, let their buckets down and use their straps that they carried buckets with as meditation straps, and so on. So it was called Gom Day. And I think one of the Rinpoches currently calls his group Gom Day. And that's what it means, the land of meditators. So while all this was going on and he was going to the land of meditators, he stayed there for like a dozen years or so. And when he was around 20, he decided to go down to his own monastery of Serpu, which is in central Tibet. And that's where all the stuff was going on. What's called the Kyushat Mongols. I like that, Kyushat. And we're not talking about shooting billiards here, folks. I don't know where they got that or what it means, but that's who they were. Had invaded Tibet and supplanted the other Mongols. And they deposed the sixth Dalai Lama. They said he wasn't the real deal. And they knew. So it was all, again, the Chinese were saying, we identify who they are. They're doing that stuff now. But this goes back 400 years they were doing that, okay? And they put Desi Sanje Jamso, the regent of Tibet, to death. So he was like the prime minister. Yeah. So with the deposing of the Dalai Lama, and the regent being put to death, the Karmapa thought, well, I got to go to Serpu. I got to go to my monastery, but I want to stay far away from all of that stuff because I've got people to teach. I've got retreats to do. And I've got a lot of important works to be about. The Nyingmas took the worst hits at that time. That's who the Kyushats decided to attack, probably because they realized there was some power there that they didn't want to be challenged by. Oh, he wasn't 20 yet. I'm sorry. He was 14. Can you imagine that? 14. And it wasn't until 1720, so when he was 17, that they enthroned a new Dalai Lama, seventh Dalai Lama. So when he was 20, he decided to leave Tibet because things were just getting too hot for him to accomplish his mission as a bodhisattva. And he took a long pilgrimage. He went to Nepal. He went to India. And he took Taisitu and Sharmapa with him. And they went to all the places, you know. They went to Kathmandu, saw Sharmapa's family. They stopped at the Budanath stupa, the big one that you always see when you see pictures of Kathmandu. Now, that stupa is really pretty special. It's supposed to hold the relics of the previous Buddha, the Buddha before Shakyamuni. And that's why it's venerated. So it's like important. They like raised money to restore the stupa. It had fallen into some need of repair. And he continued to another great stupa, is Swayambhun. And as he traveled to Namo Buddha, which was the site where in a previous life Shakyamuni was said to have given his life to feed a starving tigress. So it's a sacred place. It turns out that because that was in India, and India by that time had been overrun and the Buddhists had been run out, they were just piles of rubble there. And in fact, some of the buildings were completely underground. After this long pilgrimage and a lot of teaching, a lot of working tirelessly to satisfy the needs of those who came to meet him, they got to India, and they had debates with Hindu scholars and all that. They're famous for doing that. Taisitu was like the lion of that. The Hindus were like shocked that somebody knew Sanskrit as well or better than they did. He started to write a famous book of grammar for Tibetans in Sanskrit and Tibetan, and it's still used to this day, interestingly enough. We don't even still use McGuffey's readers in this country, but they're still using, you know, 400-year-old grammar book in Tibet. He got back to Serpu after visiting also Everest, where Milarepa had been in a cave, and Mount Kailash, which is a famous place of pilgrimage and so on, and got word from the new Manchu emperor, the one that wanted to be wise but not smart, that guy. And he said he wanted to see him in Beijing, so he decided to head off. He only took Sharmapa, and before they left, it took him 2 years to leave. You got to understand, these trips back then, it wasn't like going to the airport and hopping on a plane, boom, we're in Beijing. They prepared for 2 years, and then they took off. And he took Sharmapa with him, and he left a prediction letter for his rebirth with Taisitu and the complete lineage teachings. It took him 2 years to give them to Taisitu. And he said, "You stay here. You're my regent." Halfway to Beijing, they got to a place where there was a great epidemic. Karmapa was pretty famous for, you know, doing things like making rain where there were droughts and getting rid of epidemics by doing this and that. He was kind of magical in that way. And with smallpox. Apparently the epidemic was solved, but Karmapa contracted smallpox in the process himself and passed away halfway to Beijing. Sharmapa passed away 2 days later. Their monks embalmed them and brought them back to Serpu, where they were given the traditional funerary things and had their remains put in stupas at Serpu and all that. The 13th Karmapa lived a little longer. He lived from 1733 to 1797. And they say he was born with a mark on his tongue. And the mark was a perfect rendition of the Tibetan letter Ah, which is the symbol we use in Guru Yoga, and it represents enlightened speech. He liked retreat. he did a lot of retreat. Things had settled down enough that, you know, he didn't have to be running all over the place all the time. And he'd get in this cave up above Serpu and do retreat. At that time, Taisitu had established a big printing house in Derge, and they printed what is still the most famous Kanjur and Tenjur, the Buddhist scriptures, and is still considered the best because Taisitu had, I think it, they said it was 170 woodblocks or more that had to be carved, and he inspected each one of them 13 times to make sure there were no problems. And the king of Derge offered as much gold as could be fit into the grooves, the hollows of the woodblocks, to the carvers to motivate them to make really good woodblocks, make them really deep so they didn't wear out. So Karmapa didn't, he wasn't moving around, but apparently he didn't need to. When he was in Sikkim for a while, the king of Sikkim, who was a Dharma king, came to visit him in Serpu, but he came dressed as a servant. Karmapa recognized that this was no servant, and so he built a throne for him. And when the servant showed up with the caravan, put him on the throne, and the guy, I don't know, it's like one of those movies where the guy reveals who he really is, you know? And he was so impressed that he said to Karmapa that he would build him a monastery in Sikkim, which is, of course, it wasn't Rumtek, but of course, Sikkim is where the Karmapa's current monastery is because of the Chinese Revolution. So these connections with political people are really important. And he was invited to go bless it. Now, you know, moving around without airplanes and stuff through the Himalayas takes a long time. So he said, no, I can't go bless it. I've got too many things, but I'll bless it from here. And apparently they timed it up, and they said at certain day, certain time during the day, you know, when the sun was wherever, I'm going to say the blessing prayers, and the monks there should say the blessing prayers at the same time. And when it comes time for the blessing, I'll throw the grains of barley into the air. And apparently he did that, and he threw grains of barley into the air, and the people there, and there were like thousands of witnesses, saw barley coming out of the sky and falling on the monastery in Sikkim. There was also great floods that were happening in Lhasa at that time, where the Potala Palace was and the Jokang Monastery or temple, where the biggest Buddhist statue with relics of Shakyamuni in it is, called the Jowo. And Padmasambhava, back like 1,100, 1,200 years ago from now, you know, 500-600 years before at that point, had predicted that there'd be problems in Lhasa. Padmasambhava wrote a lot of prophecies. He said, yeah, and it was going to threaten the temples and threaten the palace, and the only one who can solve this is going to be the Karmapa. Karmapa's up in Serpu, and he said, well, I can't make it down there. I'm telling you, this guy liked retreat. So he wrote a letter that included a particular practice and particular supplication. It included the seven branch prayer and so on. In the, I don't know, supplication to Chenrezig. And he sent it with his fastest messenger down to Lhasa, and he said, just have him put this in the river. And they threw the letter in the river, and the flood subsided. Threat was over. That's why these Manchus and Mongols and Gurkhas wanted to be around these guys, because they thought they could co-opt that power for their own purposes. This retreat business is pretty good. Doing a lot of practice is pretty good. So this guy got really famous for understanding that gold is really no different than dirt. It's just appearance. And he had no problem helping anybody with anything. They say that he would walk around and he'd do transmissions to the lowest of the low, people that everybody avoided, the most annoying people, just by looking lovingly in their eyes. And he would try to plant the seeds of the Dharma in their mind streams. If somebody needed a shirt, he took off his own robes and he would give it to them. He was always giving away whatever blessing cord or whatever he had. If you needed a mala, you got his mala. Because to him, it was, he had realized the connectedness of everybody and everything and the interdependence. And he really saw himself as being somebody who needed to be out there bringing as many people to liberation as possible, no matter how long it took. So his functions were totally on that level. He did have a lot of monasteries built and all of that. At that time, Sharmapa went back to Nepal. There were some problems that started happening with that. Because of the Gurkhas and his connection to the Gurkhas politically, the Mongols and the Dalai Lama and those guys, understanding the threat politically and militarily coming from Nepal, contacted the Sharmapa and said, you know, cease and desist. And rather than following his master's example of being involved with bodhicitta and not so much with politics and power and all that, he aligned himself with the Gurkhas. He probably thought that was where which side his bread was buttered on. I don't know. And this is what happened. Sharmapa was 40 years old, traveled to Nepal, where he was welcomed by the king of the new dynasty, and established himself in Kathmandu. 10 years later, the same king who had heard of the wealth held in Tashilumpo Monastery, the seat of the Panchen Lamas in Shigatse, which is, if you remember, where the warlords were. That was a couple chapters back. Attacked Tibet and pillaged the monastery. The central government of Lhasa requested reinforcements from the Manchu Emperor Qianlong, fourth sovereign of the Qing dynasty that ruled China. The emperor hurriedly sent an army to fight against the Nepalese, chasing them back to the gates of Kathmandu. And as you know, so you've got Sharmapa on one side in Nepal, and Qianlong was a patron of the Karmapa. This is a problem. It doesn't say that right here. I'm just like highlighting that. Shortly after the 10th Sharmapa passed away in Nepal, the government of Lhasa decreed that the Yangpachen Monastery, seat of the Sharmapa in Tibet, would be confiscated. His famous red crown buried, and the Sharmapas prohibited from all official recognition from then on. The Sharmapas nevertheless continued to manifest for 150 years, but they could no longer be officially enthroned. It was not until 1964 that a Sharmapa was recognized again, this time in exile in Indian soil. Can't get into that right now, don't have enough time. But this Sharmapa was a little problematic for us in this current time. I asked Bharta Rinpoche once because I said, look, this guy's the rebirth of an enlightened mind stream. How could he be behaving like this? And Bharta just looked at me and said, ah, this incarnation's got some problems. Point is, this attraction, I think, the closer you get, the further along you get in the Dharma path, you do actually develop some skillful means. And this emphasis on bodhicitta is so important. That's the example of the Karmapas. Their example is, don't take your skillful means and your power and leverage it into something that doesn't bring wisdom and kindness into the world. And even if you kid yourself and you think, oh, if I just got the power, I could do some good, there's problems with that. Because I'm sure that's where Shamar Rinpoche was back in the 18th century. And I'm sure that's where the 6th Dalai Lama was. And it doesn't work. So that's the story of politics and the 12th and 13th Karmapas. Of course, there's a whole lot more here. But I think we'll let it rest right there. See, I did make some side notes from another book, though. Hang on. Maybe I covered them. I think so. Oh, I'll tell you one other story about the 13th Karmapa. You know, all these Karmapas love animals a lot. Anyway, there was a rabbit who came to him, and the rabbit sat up on his haunches and put his paws together like this when he saw Karmapa. And Karmapa looked right in his eyes and tried to give him a direct transmission and teach him the Dharma. And the rabbit came back every day for 3 days. And on the third day, he brought the Karmapa 3 blades of grass as a mandala to offer, thanking him for the teachings. And with that, I will conclude my talk. It's fascinating to read these guys. When you do, if you do, please use Professor Google to Google, like, what was happening in the area at the time. It's pretty great to get the whole picture. We have some time. We have for questions and answers. I hope you have some questions. I hope you have some answers. If you do, please use the question mic. Come in.
Two questions. When did the, if I pronounce it correctly, the Lamrim movement start?
Oh.
Was that around this time or was it later?
Well, that's really interesting because I think it actually, it started earlier.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, all these things arise from causes and conditions, so who knows where mm-hmm. the beginning of the beginning was. Mm-hmm. But I've always thought, this is just me, I'm not a scholar.
Right.
But I've always
me
thought
neither.
Of it as is actually coming from India with Atisha.
Oh, okay.
It developed. Right. Tsongkhapa was, in his three great treatises, he actually, concerned with the training, started that.
Okay.
And everybody, you know, along the way started developing that. Lamrim means gradual path or graded path. So there's these two trends. There's this instant, you're enlightened now, wake up, which seems attractive. But there is also Lamrim, which is gradual path. And it turns out the slow way might be the fast way, because sometimes when you're not quite ready for, you're enlightened now, you know, your ego co-opts that and crazy things happen. It's a little difficult.
Cool. Second question. I don't know if you've already covered this. Maybe I wasn't here. Was it the first Council of Lhasa?
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know how many councils of Lhasa there were. Maybe I think there was probably more than one couple.
Yeah.
But how did all of that impact what's going on here?
Well, that was where the central government of Tibet got established, I believe, during the time of the 5th Dalai Lama.
Okay. I thought it was like there was some Indian masters that came, spiritual masters, and there were some Chinese ones, and they were called by the Tibetan emperor, Tibetan king, or something like that.
Oh, well, I'm thinking of something different. I was thinking about the establishment of the central government.
I don't know. I mean, like I said, I'm not a scholar either, so I'm trying to shed light on this to help me put context into it. But my understanding is they kind of, Tibetan king said, hey, come to Lhasa and share your teachings, and we'll decide who's got the more enlightened point of view or something. And at the end of the day, the Indians won and the Chinese didn't, and there was some political ramifications to that. I don't know. And I was wondering if you did, and if so, how did that impact things?
I don't know.
Okay.
However, I do know what you're talking about. I think that was Trisung Detson.
Oh, okay.
And I think that had to do with Chinese masters and Indian masters and Padmasambhava. That's like a long time ago.
Oh, okay. All right. That's cool.
And it essentially established Vajrayana Buddhism in Tibet. That's
right.
What the outcome was.
Right, right.
It wasn't like fandom or something, you know, our team versus your team. So the Manchus, for instance, in China that took over right around now, they got their name from Manjushri. That's where Manchu comes from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
So.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure.
I have a couple questions. I'm kind of a skeptic on spiritual stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it is said that the Karmapas, you know, before they're passing away,
mm-hmm.
that they will predict their next reincarnation
mm-hmm.
and like a specific area and everything and how, you know, yep. the family and everything.
Yep.
How do they know that? Are they received like a vision, or are they just... Is it spiritual? Do they guess? Or, like, how do they know their consciousness is going to be projected into such and such child?
They do it. They're not predicting it. It's called prediction letter, but they're at the point of freedom, so they have the ability to choose. They also have insight. So the idea is that they try to figure out where the most beneficial causes and conditions will arise for basically them to practice as a bodhisattva and benefit as many beings as possible. So what they'll do is they'll say, okay, I'm going to pass away. I'm going to choose to be here. Because in this family, in this location, at this time, with these circumstances, I have the best chance to accomplish my mission.
Hmm.
So that's what's going on. It's not a matter of like miraculous crystal ball stuff.
Yeah.
when you're free, you can choose, right? Well, when you have ultimate freedom, you're not limited by the physical span of a lifetime. That's the point of the Karmapas being able to take rebirth, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, oh, it just happens. It's like, oh, no, I'm choosing. Hmm. That's why we love and are so grateful in some sense, because they choose to come back and drag our tails out of the mud until we finally get it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's not mumbo jumbo. It's a sense of choice.
And I find it interesting, a lot of the times the kids will actually pick like a item that their past...
Oh, yeah, they have to.
And it just blows my mind. Like, how do they know this, you know, or what's going on there?
Well, it's the same mind stream is what's happening. That's why... Buddhists don't really talk about reincarnation. Everybody thinks reincarnation's a thing. It's really rebirth. It's this one mind stream that's taking birth again. It's not a soul that's getting dumped into some body or some house.
Yeah, see, that was my
question. It's not like that. It's like this mind stream, and to the degree that you're free, and think about this. This is true in your own life right now. To the degree you're free, you're free to choose this or that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have such freedom literally unlimited freedom, that they can choose the circumstances into which they'll be born. That's the idea.
Hmm. All right.
So it's an expression. It's not an expression of spiritual mumbo jumbo. It's an expression of freedom.
Yeah. All right. Yep. That's it.
That's it. Yep. Yeah. Actually, you know, it's like if you know how to do calculus, that will seem like mumbo jumbo to somebody who only knows arithmetic. It's like, what? You can calculate the area under a curve? Oh, my God. That's magic. And you can do what with that? Oh, my God. Well, this is like that, except even cooler. All right. Well, thank you all for coming today and allowing me to share this with you. Let's take a moment and dedicate the merit. Let's dedicate the merit to all the people who feel entangled by their circumstances, that they can be free of it. And upon their freedom, recognize the basic goodness in themselves and benefit beings all day, every day. And enjoy the happiness of that. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free. Soha.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.